Hi
So
there.
I have set the recording going now.
That's fine.
Here's Doug.
You're sideways, Doug. Oh, that's better.
He's always sideways when he comes on, and then and then the world realigns somehow.
It's a reflection of my life.
Like, actually, in your apartment, you probably walk around with Velcro shoes on your wall, right? Like, that's, and you just have to turn the cameras for our sake.
Hi, Marco.
Oh.
Hello, Miranda.
So you'll be happy to see that I have the recording on now.
It's the first thing I looked for.
Johnny noted that he won't be coming.
Yeah, he said he hadn't read the material yet. He could have come anyway, but...
Yeah.
I'm expecting Jocelyn. I talked to her last night, and I guess Donna will come too, but and I don't know about Katina, whether she'll come or not.
How is everybody?
Like, emotionally not very great after reading Parable of the Talent. That was an extremely difficult book.
So. I agree with that, yeah.
Yeah, it was worse than the first one. Hi, Jocelyn. We're only seeing the top of your head, Jocelyn. There you go.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Doug came on sideways, so, you know, there are some alignment issues, right? So.
Since I'm often traveling, I utilize my phone for conversations. And then I set it on top of my laptop, because my laptop has a fan that's constantly buzzing in the background that registers on when we're talking. So that's my sideways story there. So I have to rotate the phone over.
I'm artist residency with a bunch of people, so I'm in a bit of a, I just snuck away, so I feel like I'm a bit of a strange space. It's like a sonic cyber feminism thing, so it's quite nice, but it's actually everyone's a fan of Octavia Butler, and people brought her up without me even mentioning what I'm working on these days, so there is a connection. But it's nice to see you all again.
Yeah. What time is it there? Is it 5 or 5 in the evening?
Yeah, it's 5 in the...
Yeah, afternoon. Yeah, yeah.
Wait, what time is it where you are?
12 here. Although Marco's in 10, I think, so. And Doug, too, I guess, right?
I'm sorry, I muted, but I wanted to say hi. And when I say hi, I realized that I was muted. Sorry.
Well, we might as well get started. There may be a couple more people who come in after we get going a little bit. But Mary, you were the one who said that it was a bit of a bit of a slog, this.
I read this one. You guys might or might not know. I had to be evacuated from a boat earlier this month. And so we ended up just like waiting around in lounges with all the other people who had to be evacuated. And they all wanted to come talk to me. And I was reading this. And it had me sort of on the edge of tears several times. And people wanted to come up and ask me about like flight schedules and things. And I was really not in the mood for that. this one was pretty hard. I think it's all the, like it's losing, like a chapter 12, they've lost their children, right? It's just like the worst possible thing that can happen. Maybe that's hyperbole, but it feels like the worst possible thing that can happen to people. And resolution is a long time coming in this book. It's she just leaves us in this really horrible place for a really long time. So yeah, no, it was a hard book. Beautiful, and obviously, I think the fact that it spoke to me that much is a testament to Octavia Butler's skill. But you're just reading about your nightmare constantly, all the time. So that was my experience of it.
And she spent such a long time building up the importance of the children to the, it's like every chapter focused on, oh, well, the children really matter. This person really, they would do anything for their children. And I noticed there was a strong, so she set us up, right? So.
Yeah, they're the most important, not just for the reasons that children are the most are important to their parents, but also just because Lauren is so oriented towards the future, and those children were the future that she was going for, and they're gone. So,
and that's only the latest in a string of calamities that befall the characters in this book, from the beginning where they've established a small community in Acorn to the part where we're at now, which is chapter 12, where that community has been taken over by a political, theopolitical faction, paramilitary kind of, what to call them exactly, like almost like a Taliban, like an American Taliban.
With Trump overtones.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the interesting things about this book is, and I was just looking for exactly where it comes up, but this is the book where Make America Great Again is the campaign slogan of the president. In the beginning, he's the candidate, Texas Senator Andrew Steele Jarrett. And he's a little bit different than Trump because he seems more of a religious fundamentalist. He's like more of a true believer than Trump, who doesn't, you know, really just seems to believe in himself. So besides the children being taken away from their parents, there's rape, there's child slavery, there's more killing, there's, you know, people losing. I think like the loss of significant others is a theme here. The last book ends with the community, burying, or not burying, but I guess giving their dead to the orchards and to the trees, and they plant trees and they start anew with Acorn. But now, you know, each of the characters, the first new one we meet is Dan Oyer, I believe, who's a young boy. He's like 15 or so. He's like Olamina's age at the beginning of the last book, but he's now lost his entire family and the community takes him in. So it's just trauma after trauma after trauma in this. And I really found it hard to read. I read it in one chunk and then I had to take a break from it. And then I read the second chunk leading up to this call. But I can see why Butler said, as she was working on the sequels to this, there were to be three or five books in the series that she couldn't, that it was too depressing. That's one of the reasons she stated for not completing the books. And I'm glad that it's not this bad. So this makes me a little bit thankful for the relative normalcy of contemporary America, even though for some people it's bad. It's not, what she describes here is horrific. And it's like the worst case scenario, I think, of, you know, the trajectory that we're on.
Although it might not be happening in North America, but it is happening elsewhere, you know, like it's, yeah, we might not have gotten it right in our backyard, but we didn't not get it either.
That's a very good point. And I've even in Canada compared to the US, I've been in Vancouver. I went down, I forgot the name of the street one night and I was like, oh my God, this is like apocalyptic. Because I haven't seen that in the United States, with just camps of people, homeless people, open, you know, drug use, and so it is sort of almost just removed, you know, because we will tend to, I think, exist and live our lives in, you know, comfort zones. You know, there's a certain zone in which we operate. And but just step outside of that, not even very far. Doesn't have to be Syria or Pakistan or Afghanistan. I think that's a very good point.
In our first conversation, I think, before we even began reading the books, we noted Butler's prophetic voice. How, in a way, she's able to, at least from Jeffrey's reading of the biography and a few others who had read the books, noted that she, and I think going off of the comment, "Make America Great Again," there's this sense of prophetic voice in Butler's work, and she does throw in tidbits that. Seem a little far-fetched for us, our minds here, but this is on the verge of Holocaust material here, once they get enslaved by the splinter group, I guess, of the Jarrett's Christian America. But there's other notes that could have happened here in America where Texas, the state, wanted to secede from the nation because of what was going on in the country. I think that was during the Obama years. And so Alaska being a separate entity from the United States and a war going on between the states ties in with some of her reflections on the past through maybe her book Kindred, which I haven't read, but just the civil war that the United States has gone through. So it's almost taking some of those elements along with futuristic elements or SF elements into foreseeing element what could possibly happen. So it's not too far-fetched, a lot of her material here, but it's a good thing. It's more of a warning a lot of the times that this is possible. If Christianity overpowers the belief system, then they can take over a country, or if a religion takes over. So just wanted to note that. Hello, Donna.
Yeah, hi, Donna.
So, hi, Donna. We were talking about how bleak the book is and how a bit depressed we all are after having read the first 12 chapters of the book.
Ah, really? Well, I myself, I'm very much enjoying it, actually. I mean, I loved it. I loved this, the second edition, more than the first. I have to confess, I mean, here she really... Butler is amazing in her writings, in the character itself, development of the character, the events, the depth. I felt there is more depth here. I mean, I felt in the first book, Butler was in a way introducing us, and in a way she was like, she didn't want to shock us what she really wants to say. And in this one, I mean, I'm almost finishing it. it's amazing. I mean, for me, I enjoyed it. This one, I enjoyed it more than the first one. The characters, everything, the themes that were presented. I mean, I felt it's more, really has more depth. This is how I felt. I enjoyed it.
So that's encouraging for when we read on a bit, I guess, because most of us are still stuck in chapter 12 when everything went to pieces, right? So
I was hoping maybe today we could talk about Marco, and I know he is also you know, we've only read the first half, and so we don't want to talk about Marco maybe in the second half, but I think there's something really interesting about like the call to be a religious leader, and Marco, obviously her brother, feels like he's got a call in the same way that she does, but it's not the same. And anyway, I think Butler was exploring something pretty interesting there. Just wondered what you guys thought about that.
Yeah, and going off of that, with the book as a whole, this second book is the, maybe what Donna could confirm, is that the first one is planting seeds of positivity towards this religion that Lauren's developing. And then to, sorry, I'm hearing my own voice here. But she's sowing seeds of doubt by introducing her own child, who we don't know anything about at the beginning, but saying she essentially despises her mother and this religion that she's formed. And when Marco introduces her, comes back to comes back into the picture, he doesn't quite agree with his sister. So there's a lot of doubt about her own religion here. Before we're all liking this God has changed. I thought about joining the club and starting my own religion or something. God has changed, but now I have doubts.
Well, if I can say, in the first book, I had many questions. One of them was, who is telling the story? In the first book, I wanted to raise this question. Now, the first book, I was really wondering, who is telling the story? Is it Lauren, or is it now? Is it the past? Is it the future? Someone discovering her journals. And the second book, in a way, answered. I was really thinking about, when is this story happening? Is it in the future? Is it somebody reading it? Is it the character herself, the main character? And then when I started the second book and I discovered that, yes, this is the future generation looking back, seeing, you know, revisiting history, revisiting culture, religion, whatever. And all the time I'm reading it not from a religious perspective, but I'm reading it from a more literature characters development. So one of the answers was the characters, who is telling me the story, who is now, from whose point of view I'm seeing the events, what's happening. The second answer was, sometimes you have this opinion or this, you stick to a religion or whatever, and then you think that this is the only way or this is the only truth. And then when I saw the character of the daughter and how she was, in a way, not criticizing her mother, but reviewing. And this is really what happens in the history in for us everywhere. I mean, we go back and we sometimes you think, yeah, this is the only way, this is the right way. And then you go back and you start looking into history and you start studying history and you start, what if? Were the events really like that? Were the events told from that point of view or from that point of view? I mean, for me, I felt, yes, this book, it has so many elements. Butler was really writing in a very, very dense, lots of depth in it, in terms of the building the characters. And us discovering. And for me, for example, Lauren was very idealistic, was like, yes, and this, and we can do this, and we can build this new religion and this and that. And she was so away from reality. And her brother, when he told her this, what happens and this and that. And then in this book, I felt finally she faced reality. She faced what we really as humans face. And I'm really excited to see how Lauren would deal, I mean, towards the end of the book, what's going to happen. So this is my point of view of the book so far.
In my edition, it's got like a reading group guide at the end where I guess Octavia Butler was interviewed for it. And she says that she was stuck on this story for a long time, and what got this novel going again was the decision to use the daughter as the frame, and that she decided to do that after her own mother had died, so to make it about a mother-daughter relationship. So I thought that was kind of interesting. That just gives it some context.
And she also gives a voice to Buncle. So some of the early texts had small segments that were written from the point of view of Buncle, which I thought was really interesting too, because it gave an offset position understanding and some insight into what was going on in his mind, because we mostly saw him through Lauren and to some extent the daughter. But it was interesting to see, because that's another thing I noticed about this book. Like if you, all of the people who seem to be considered to be in some sense heroic are women, and very few of them are men. And so to give voice to Banco was to give a voice to the masculine within the book. Where it's clearly a book that's more oriented towards the feminine. So I did find the fact that she gave some space to Bunkle's point of view interesting from that perspective.
And same with Keith, he has an excerpt in there from The Warrior, which I don't think we know too much about. But he... I guess going back to what you were saying, Mary, he has the actual, like Lauren in a way does have the pain, the experience of the pain through hyperempathy, but she hasn't necessarily gone through the, I don't know how to say it, or being taken away from her own mind to the point where she was a slave. Well, I guess now in a way she is with her, she's collared, but so she's experiencing what Marco experience. So like Donna's saying, she's waking up to reality. That's part of their come together, was that Marco is saying she doesn't really understand pain. She doesn't understand the reality of the situation or of Christian America, and that they, or whoever might enslave, that they're serious, that the pain introduced is serious. And that was enough to make him want to get out of there and find something else and not believe in what she was saying.
That slave collar is horrifically realistic. I mean, I could imagine it. Like, I could imagine how, you know, you'd have it like connected to you like have an app or something, you know, it'd be like slaver app. And I can just see it, you know, that's what was, disturbing about it, but the perspective of Larkin, the daughter, I found was another, like a subtler level of the pain in this book, because she starts this off with a big hint of what happens later on. The first thing, I think we lost Jeffrey. The first thing she says is that they'll make a god of her. And then we learn in the next page or two that she's dead. So already we sort of know where this story is going. Like we know that she's going to lose her life. She's going to be martyred. She's going to be martyred in some way. And this daughter has grown up almost without the mother that she needed. And like she sees her mother as having chosen this idealistic vision, this, you know, for all intents and purposes, delusional dream, you know, that got her killed, got her father killed, got set up whatever conditions that the author or the compiler of these notes, Larkin, is conveying to us. So, I mean, as a parent, I know that like the time that you spend on your own stuff compared to on your children, like one always feels guilty about that. And I found myself feeling, oh, this is like, you know, if my children were to reconstruct their own upbringing and like go back and look through my notes, like my writings or something like that, and try to piece together, like, why didn't dad spend more time with us or something? I'm not a bad parent, but that's what it kind of got me thinking is, wow, this is setting up this whole like drama of intergenerational pain and disappointment and anger and resentment, and you know how you can't control ultimately how your own children are going to see you. And so it really, I think what Donna was saying earlier, the emotional depth is so much greater. And I think it's partly because we're getting these different perspectives. Not only do we have an adolescent Olamina's perspective as the only, you know, the main perspective of Parable of the Sower. Here we have the daughter, we have Bancole, we have Marcus or Marcos. He changed his name. That was the other thing. He sort of went through a transformation from Marcus, I guess, Olamina to Marcus to Marcos Duran. So I would like to come back to that as well, but I just wanted to note that one, the one thing about Larkin's perspective and how, she might be young as well. Like she may come to appreciate things differently as she grows older. But this is seems to be really coming almost to like set the record straight, you know, or almost to counteract whatever is happening in the post Olamina, you know, community, Earthseed community, where they're mythologizing her perhaps in some way, and she's trying to show another side. Like this might be like a Gnostic kind of gospel or something, or sort of non-canonical, you know, book in the Earthseed canon. It's interesting to imagine like kind of where this is really coming from, and I think that's part of what also gives it more depth.
I guess building on what you've said, the intergenerational trauma is quite, I think it's quite important, and I think is seems to be coming to the surface, but through a really interesting, like fragmentary storytelling. So the sort of multivocality and the fragments of revealing these glimpses of Acorn, what happened there is, yeah, like how what it might be counteracting is really fascinating.
I think it must have taken a lot of guts as a writer to have built up Acorn so much and then just wipe it out, you know, like it, well, in that last, in the chapter 12, like just Acorn was the happy ending of book one, and like we've already lost it by the middle of book two. It's a really dramatic. It's
they couldn't even put up a fight either. It was like, no. It just got overrun. It wasn't. There was no challenge. No problem.
It was in like four pages. It was done. Yeah.
I wanted to to say also that usually when I read, I am pretty much very involved in what I've read. And even if it's something that is not really quite interesting, Like, for example, if I read some maths, I will find a story to myself to get involved in the in what is written in order to catch my attention, to feel more immersed, to understand and to put, like, you know, to draw something in my brain that is going to help me to get engaged. But here in this book, it was, I would say, like, horrible because... And I have to say that I had to close the book many times and find a process of detachment. So I did the complete opposite of what I do usually to get to read the book. Basically, I tried to put myself out the story, even from the first line I read. It was like having all this, it was... so immersive, and it's a type of story I cannot get into because it's so awful that I don't want to get part of my reality. I want this story to be not part of me, not part of my reality. It's not something that I want to ever think even about it. So it was like having like a big fight while reading it. And I would say like her demonstration was very strong in the term of, you know, how you can demonstrate that religion as brings big issues to people, like cannot solve anything, is by showing that when you have a strong disaster, I mean, the only way to get you out of there is to find a meaning of life. And meaning of life usually is set up on life of children. So if you're fully immersed of the life, in the life of your children, you are fully involved in this kind of meaning of life. And without that, you are not in the meaning of life, so to speak. But here she demonstrates two things from my point of view. She demonstrates, first of all, that meaning of life is not what you think it is, and religion cannot help for the meaning of life somehow, and instead is doing the opposite because it gives you some kind of a lecture or what it's supposed to be, and it's the complete opposite of what you can leave your meaning of life somehow. So it's so powerful, and she, her writing style is so immersive that it was very difficult to put some kind of keys of detachment. I had to close the book, I don't know how many times, and think about something else, like my chemistry courses or something to get me out of this story. It was really, very tough. And I have children myself, and I would say, yes, it is the worst nightmare, but also, how could I say that? She gets us guilty somehow. Like you say, like, you know, like, well, how much time I spend with them. things like that. Things that really get you into your guts. And I really didn't want to go there. But you had to go there. So like, you know, you don't want to go. And then, you know, sentence 23, you are there. and you say, no, don't get me there. But she's so strong that even if it is very sad and it's powerful, it's sad, you feel sad, but she really leads you to, I mean, I feel like she is pulling her demonstration in a way that you cannot really escape the logic of it, the emotional logic of it. Like you have to feel this deepest, worst thing that could happen to you in order to understand what she's trying to show, what she's trying to demonstrate. I felt something like this in the first book, but it was another kind of powerfulness. was something else. But here she really demonstrates that she is able to immerse a person completely. Like it's, of course, it's not a physical immersion, but almost physical, because when you talk about death, you are like touching something very physical, that even if it is just, you know, in your mind, it's bringing some kind of reality. I mean, some kind of embodiment. And so you are in there and you don't want to be there. But she holds you there, and I would say like she even put your head under the water to see how long you cannot breathe. And then she demonstrates, she's trying to call for enlightenment or something, not about religion, but about how you build your own reality, how you can take something meaningful without anything related to social obligation somehow, and it's I was not able, like others, to go to the happy part. I mean, to feel a little bit lighter, because it was so strong, and so I stay like I'm still the head under the water somehow. But I can see that she is really pulling off to build her demonstration and try to go closer to this social obligation and emotional trigger. I mean, she's playing with that so nicely. And I would say like, she's like kind of she's scissoring things, and she's trying to put every block in place to build her demonstration as something that you cannot take something else to say, oh, but it's not exactly this way, you can have added that or this. Here, there is no possibility of going around. You are in there, and it's like a sharp demonstration of what she wants to say, what she wants to show. And it's disturbing, but it's powerful. And I was not the best reader in this one, because I had to to cut up the flow, and it's really a flow from head to toe. It's really a flow, so I had it to cut it so many times that and I guess it's what's saved me somehow, because I didn't want to be part of this. I really felt I need detachment, but in two or three phrases she brings you in. You know, she has this power to bring you in. So, it was difficult to read, really. But it's so well done. I would say, like, her demonstration is so powerful that I still have the chills. I still have the chills of the... And I don't know how you did it, Murray, to go back to your activities after that, because I was not able to. I had to take a break after this. Yeah.
When you were describing how you had to stop several times, I thought, Jocelyn, it just reminded me of her descriptions of hyper-empathy. Like you were having that problem. You were having hyper-empathy with the book, and you think that something like hyper-empathy is going to be a great gift, and it turns out that it just feels horrible. Yeah.
I must admit that I don't think my reaction was quite as extreme as yours, Justin. But I also had to, I couldn't read this all in one go. I had to step forward, step away, step forward, step away. I mean, partly because I had a very busy 2 weeks, but it wasn't motivated. I mean, I put it aside for long periods of time, just because it was hard to go back to, even though, as you say, the writing is very compelling. And so eventually it pulled me back, but I had to do these long loops before I was ready to go back. So I do agree with Donna that there's more depth to the book, and that there's more, the character is evolving in more interesting ways than in the first book. She really was a fairly static character, in terms of character development. It was more us getting to know what was going on rather than the character developing. But in this book, there is some of those changes going on, and it makes it, from a literary perspective, more interesting, I guess. But from an emotional perspective, I found it really difficult, definitely.
I'd like to ask a question of the group. It's one of the themes, regards one of the themes that comes up in these chapters. And it's the question of purpose and destiny. And this is maybe more intellectual, maybe it's not as pain oriented, but it is important to Olamina, and she stresses this, and she and Bencole have arguments about it, that humans need a transcendent purpose. They need something that they could work for, attain, give their lives for. And that without that, she argues, that things fall apart, people turn on each other. And it's really important to her, and this is one of the differences between her, her religion and her brother's religion, is that this is a purpose that in her mind is realistic because it's achievable. Like, it's technologically feasible, or she could imagine vaguely how it could be feasible that human beings spread from planet Earth to other planets and, you know, achieve a kind of species immortality or a social immortality or something like that through their children and progeny. And it's interesting because you learn that even the members of her community who are most skeptical at first have come around, and they're now, in the face of Marcus's criticisms, are defending Earthseed and are really questioning him and his view, his more Christian view of a transcendental purpose, of a purpose that, you know, is not of human means, is not achieved by humans. So it was one of the things that on the less emotionally painful level got me thinking more in terms of, well, like, how, you know, what are the ways that people can or do collectively orient around these big transcendent goals, and how important is it to cultivate that in a cultural or a social sense, and what does it mean if we don't have that? Like, it seems now, like, on a larger scale, doesn't seem to be a collective goal or purpose or meaning to, you know, our lives. So I
think I was maybe raised in a culture that resisted the idea of transcendent goals. I remember my dad was a minister in a United Church in Canada. That's Methodist churches would be the equivalent in the States. And I remember someone once saying to him something like, what's a church for? And he said, his response was, what's a family for? Like, sometimes things just are to exist, and it's the human relationships have intrinsic value, but they don't have to go to something. And then later, when I became a scientist, I'm a microbiologist, but, you know, you talk about evolution a lot, and the current in science has been to move away from a goal-oriented view of evolution, the idea that this force was like going somewhere. So I think, when you said that, my first response was, no, of course you don't need transcendent goals. Because a lot of my personal life and my professional life was about rejecting the ideas of transcendent goals. So I know that's not necessarily typical, though.
So it's interesting that you raised the question, Marco, because I remember, like, the whole discussion about whether or not the space program, like, so you have this discussion going on in her books, whether or not the space program is a good thing or a bad thing. And so in the first book, you had the dismantling of the space program by the then president and or president-elect. And then in this book, again, you have these same questions coming up. But that was an actual part of the public discourse in North America, certainly, in the 60s during the Apollo effort, and also in the 70s and 80s with the space shuttle effort, where people said, you know, these things cost a fortune. Are we sure this is where we want to be putting our money? As opposed to fixing the earth and the ecology and, you know, any problems that were rising at that point and people were becoming more and more aware of. And so, you know, it is a discussion that I've been aware of most of my life in the media. And it's one that I've had I've always been in favor of a space exploration, but I understand the other side of the argument, if you like. And so so I'm a bit like Butler in that way, in the sense that I'm more inclined to favor that. But I, you know, as she lays out the sort of counter arguments in her books. And of course, today we have Elon Musk and this whole I'm just picking him, but he's not the only one. But the sort of private industry space guru kind of figure that's become the leader of the argument of going to other planets, but as a kind of private enterprise goal rather than a government humanitarian kind of goal, the way the earlier argument went. And, you know, I'm not happy, in a way, I'm not that happy with the private enterprise shift, although I think it may be necessary in a kind of a long-term view, but making the private enterprise be the be-all and end-all of going to the other planets doesn't seem to me a great way to go either in this context. So, I did like what you, I think it was Jocelyn, you said something about that what Butler's, so it's interesting because I was drawn to the Butler books partly because of their religious undertones or overtones, but I think you're right. I think in a way it's not, although the book has a lot to do with religion, in a way it's really about visioning the future and how you build visions of the future than it is about religion per se. And so it's that sort of comment is pertinent to Marco's question, which is also, you know, how do we take those lessons from the book and bring them back into the world that we live in? So it's not a full answer, but it's some ideas about the question that you raised, Marco.
I think one good thing about Lauren too is if you were on the outside perceiving on paper what she was about, you would say, well, the destiny is to go to the stars. I'm sorry, I'm not buying into that, but she has her community and it's not a requirement for everyone to believe. Like, it's not a requirement to be a part of that community to believe in that. It's a requirement in some sort of fashion to question what is around you, just as they question Marcos with his religious beliefs. And she questioned, I don't know if it came up in the actual sermon he gave and then the following questions, but she's questioning, well, what about the role of women in your religion? They're told to essentially just shut it and let the men do their job, just as religions had in the past. So she's, in a way, you can cancel out the religious aspect of it, or even the transcendental, and focus on the here and now. We're trying to build this community. We're planting the seeds, literally, of eggplants and trees and lemon trees and whatnot, so we can form a group, and it's up to you to spread the news that the core tenet of God is change. If you don't like the word God, then you can focus on life is change or something like that. And she's open to that, which is a good thing. But deep down inside, she knows what she wants. She has that strong drive to see her vision come to fruition, because I don't know if her perspective, it will be a paradigm shift. Just simply having humanity separate from the earth allows us to glimpse down at the earth as a species and give us a new perspective on life. That doesn't really come up in the book all too much, but yeah, I think she's starting here, and Marco noted that she wanted to write 3, 4, or 5 more books, and no telling where she was going to take this. But for the time being, there's a lot of negative change that they have to deal with. So the focus isn't on reaching the stars, although that's in the back of her mind and maybe a few of her core believers. But I like the educational aspect, the questioning, the focus on starting a library. When they first get the truck, they get a load of books. They're not going out to go shoot up some people or something crazy like that. Or take over communities so they can spread the news. They want to bring knowledge to the forefront of their vision so people can read, so they can potentially get jobs in other communities and spread knowledge. So I like that aspect of her religion.
Yeah, there's an immediate practical, she's paying attention to every aspect of the scale, the grand vision and the plan for tomorrow and everything that seems to legitimize her viewpoint, you know, that it translates into immediate concrete action.
Do you feel it's a plausible religion? Like, I think it works as literature. Would it work in real life?
Just as I'm an outsider to Quakerism in general, but I did join the Quaker community just to have something for my family the past year. And I feel a lot of resonance with what she's doing there, with what Quakerism is about in a lot of ways. But I don't know. It's a good question.
I mean, it's fulfilling. When I think about the needs that I think are fulfilled by religion, she's hitting a lot of them. It's something that gives you a framework to guide your actions and perceive the world. It creates a community. What else is religion for? Is a genuine question. What are people's spiritual needs that get fulfilled by this?
Well, it has this thing of, I suppose, normally religion gives a sense of security. And it's one of the things that she remarks on, Lauren, a number of times, that the Earthseed approach is not necessarily one that gives a lot of security or sense of security. It's more, as we were saying, a kind of questioning role. Although I guess there is a kind of security that arises from having a community, more than having the religion say things that make you feel secure. It's more the sense of community that gives the stability and the reassurance. To come to Doug's comments, I mean, the Quakers are very questioning also. And yet there is a sense of security inside because the Quakers are underneath a Christian community, even though there's a lot of, I don't know how to say it. There's a lot of people who are present in the Quaker community who aren't Christians, and there are a lot of practices that don't necessarily require that you sign on to a Christian point of view in order to take part in the communities. And so so it has a lot of porosity to it as a group. And in that way, it's like this Earthseed group as well. So naively, I would have said it would be difficult to maintain a religion like this, because I don't think it gives quite enough security for people. But Doug's point is an interesting one.
It gives, I mean, it might not give a traditional, might not give the same kind of security, but if you reframe it a little, it gives people a sense of power over their world. Like, she insists again and again that it is within human capability to shape the changes that are going on. And so there might be security in that, in the idea that you're, that nobody is powerless.
She also points out it's a very immanent kind of religion. It's not a very transcendent. In fact, there's very little transcendent elements to it. It's the God that she's talking about is the engagement with the world around us rather than any kind of notion of any kind of beyond.
Yeah, I guess from my perspective, what have I done? Oh, wait, no, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
All right, sorry. from my perspective, not really, I guess, knowing more about political organizing than religious organizing. For me, it felt like a intentional community and utopian and possibly anarchist in the sense of, you know, Mary, you're talking about agency. But I guess pointing to the fragility of that and sort of engaging with a lot of the of different perspectives on how difficult intentional communities are to maintain and grow. But it's interesting to learn more about the different, how this relates to other forms of religion.
Yes, tremendously hard. I had my cousin's wife is a journalist, and I remember she did an article on an intentional community for a magazine a few years ago. And by the time it had come out, the community had broken up. I think it's sort of a testament to the force of Lauren's personality that she does manage to keep people together. Is actually pretty incredible.
Well, I think where we're at now with in chapter 12, where this community has been completely disempowered, like that. This is a blow to the doctrine of shaping God. They've worked so hard to cultivate their land, to become productive, to build in their numbers and in their practices and rituals, and it seems like a vibrant, strong community, and it is just clobbered by this, by larger forces than itself. So I don't know how that's going to ultimately unfold, but I think it does kind of put maybe those idealistic aspirations or intentions sort of more maybe is more humbling, and maybe that's a quality even that's not as present in Olamina as it might be in a more mature spiritual leader or in more mature spiritual vision. I hope that's not too much of a leading sort of question, because I'm just noticing that right now. Like, yeah, it's great to have real, a very passionate vision for the future. But if you can't recognize the ways in which that vision is there are much larger things going on, larger forces at play, than reality will find a way, it seems, to correct your perception on that.
That is one of the things that I think makes this book so amazing is that Butler lets her characters be wrong about things. Like, Olamina clearly got some, well, this is maybe not, I don't mean to blame Olamina, but something went wrong. Like this is a, it, something didn't work. And it would be, I think, so easy as an author, it is so easy as an author just to smooth problems out of the path of your character and let them succeed because they are your protagonist. And I think that makes this book remarkable. And yeah, and you said like it gets wiped out, but you notice the book's not over too. Like that in itself is its own message. Acorn has fallen, but we've still got, I don't know, 100 or 200 pages left to go, so.
And I also find the book really interesting. I mean, obviously it's part of the reason why I was drawn to read it. Because of course in my own books, I have my own religious movement, which is also my invention and is different from hers. And I have many of the same issues come up in my world. So it's interesting to see what she does with hers. And it informs me for how I need to take my own characters and my own plots forward in order to resolve some of these issues in my books. So.
What I would like to add also, and maybe I didn't, because I was so interrupted in my reading on purpose, I would like to add also something about the notion of reality, because I think while using all this immersion process, because she's really very skilled in leading you into this immersion of sad feeling that you cannot really escape. And she, while using this this immersion process, she's really trying also to show her point of view somehow about her. I felt like she's trying to demonstrate something about her point of view about religion and a point of view especially about reality, like for using this process that could work, I'm sure, even with people who doesn't have children, because it's not only about the children, it's more about what do you put in children, and children can be also something that you care so much about it, or something that you really put all your energy on it. And is it really the meaning of life of doing this? So this is the first part that I really get into. And the second part is that, well, anything you do to get you some feeling, like if you feel sad, it's just like, you create your sadness somehow. You can create it using emotion and you are in it. And this is the meaning of life. It's creating emotion. And emotion brings you into situations that lead you to reality. And it's like an overgrowth process that she's leading you inside it. And you cannot really get out. You cannot say, well, I will have no emotion from now. I don't want to get even in the reality of what I'm reading. I just want to get out. And I don't want to be in this emotion. So I acknowledge I reacted very strongly, but she is trying to make her point. And even if you feel like detachment is the key, you cannot really get out the emotion. And what I try to figure out is that, well, for her, emotion is reality, and it is because religion trying to get to everyone in the same page of emotion that works. However, if you're feeling so mad or so not in tune with the other's emotion, you cannot be part of this region, because they are, you cannot share anymore this feeling. So you are not in it somehow, but you are maybe more in your own reality. So it was a very complicated path that she took to show that, I mean, her point of view. However, I found it very, how could I say, like, it was full of poetry and also very strong and leading. She's trying to lead us to something that is her own spiritual point of view. And when you think about religion, you don't think about emotion. You think about something that brings people all together in the social social gathering and the same beliefs. But you don't think about so much about what can they share. And emotion is why the religion try to, you know, not to make it too big, not to make it to help people to go together through the life and through events of life. But when something awful like this, losing your children, happen, well, the only thing that could pop up is emotion, and it's not going with the flow with this, and you feel disconnected with the reality. And she's really showing us this very clearly. And I would say, like, in a more philosophical point of view, the transcendent part of, you know, going into understanding what's going on with, you know, feeling, emotion, and representation of this emotion, and trying to share this emotion with others, it's usually something that we don't go into because of our religion's belief. We were born this way. So trying to go at around and to show that in another way without being not respectful of the belief of the people is very difficult. And I think that she succeeded somehow to show this process and how to have another point of view without being shocking. And it's really something that is admirable in her way she writes, because it's very difficult to do something like this about religion without shocking and really get everyone involved in this. I would say that's a really big difficult part she did, because I'm sure that it's kind of a universal point of view she presented here. No one can say, well, you know, the only thing we can say is that, well, it's not a nice story to talk about the death of your children. It's not nice. But despite of that, it's pretty universal, and everybody recognizes themselves. Even if they don't have children, they can acknowledge the feeling, they can acknowledge the emotion. So it was really powerful in that sense, that you really touched something very dear to everyone, because we always have either way be the children of someone else, or have children, or have something related to parentality somehow that is leading us to this feeling. So and for me, this is a text that really shows a point of view about religion, about what is for her the way we are in reality somehow. Yeah, sorry.
I think part of what Octavia Butler is doing here is this is also her thinking process. And so she develops a point of view and then associates it with a character. but she also argues against herself, argues against what might be her own point of view in her characters. And I think that's one of the things that fiction allows an author to do. That's one of the ways that it enables complex thought and more inquiry, questioning. But I feel like there's a, how do I put this? But these are not just characters. I mean, I think that these are expressions of the author's mind, of the author, of Octavia Butler's own working out of her beliefs. Like, and I think we talked about this in a previous call, that that these verses of Earthseed may have been verses that she took seriously. They may have been like ways that she guided her own response to life. And she told the story as a way of illustrating that or exploring the ideas. But I think she took them, this is just my hunch, right? But I think she took them seriously. All these verses that she repeats from the first book, I've heard her in interviews recite them. And I think they're really interesting because they do actually do what Lauren says they do, which is that they string together things like observations. Like each of the components of Earthseed, I think you could find in other thought systems or other, like Taoism, Nietzsche, Buddhism, certainly science fiction, the space race, like politics, because this is coming also out of an observation on human nature. And I'm sort of trying to almost circle back to the question I asked as to whether this is plausible. Sometimes I find myself imagining, like, what would it be like to be a believer, right, of Earth? Like, could I adopt this worldview myself? And would it make sense? Like, would it actually kind of meet those needs that one has for meaning, purpose, security, comfort, etc. But also philosophically, so that it makes sense as an account of reality. Like, that's the thing that is, I think, interesting, is that it's like, philosophically, if we were to just break down her verses and discuss them point by point as to whether they were true, I think that we would find that I think we'd find that they make sense. Like, if you make certain, how do I put this? Starting with certain axioms, like start with the axiom of a God that has these qualities, right? And she describes what those are, and you could observe them, and you can call that God. You may not want to call it God. Heraclitus didn't call it God. Nietzsche didn't call it God, but she calls it God because she's trying to create a religion. But I think that one could go through and actually kind of discern the theology here and like write a treatise or something, like write exegesis on the Earthseed verses and begin to develop like a secondary literature, on the different hermeneutics of Earthseed and actually build out what the worldview would be from the verses and then from the stories. Because then you have Lauren as the originator, the founder, but then you have her disciples. Like, it starts out with 13 people at Acorn, right? So there's her and the other 12, and they all scatter, but then they kind of multiply. So I don't know, maybe in some kind of virtual reality of the future, there would be like an Earthseed cult or something like that. I don't know if I'm responding to you, Jocelyn, because you were talking about reality and how this is a vision of reality. And I think it is. Like, I think it's philosophy and as much as it is fiction. And I think, like, the question of, like, what unites human beings on a large scale is really crucial. It's interesting that we need Elon Musk and, you know, private corporations to give transcendent purpose. Like, okay, Mars is not only an aspiration, it's also security. Like, Elon Musk sees it as a backup to Earth. Like, if things don't work out here, we'll have some place to go and establish a new outpost of you know, the remains of our civilization. And I think that for a lot of people, especially like technology oriented people, and like, that's actually a plausible religion. And that, and or combined with like the idea of, you know, singularity, a computer singularity, and like that, that's, that actually functions much as a religion. And what is, I think, notable is that our nation states are not doing that. So whereas in the 50s, 60s, we may have, as nations, as particularly the United States, fashioned an identity and a sense of common shared purpose on our capacity to go to the moon, to develop very advanced technology, to outcompete the Soviet Union. But we don't have that anymore. Like, there's total lack, a disintegration of faith in the public public project. So we have to turn to other sources of that. I think that now is emerging in these private enterprises, and certainly all the kind of splinter groups and all the smaller, you know, subgroups and subcultures and cults and so forth. Humans will have to find something to unite them, and if it doesn't come at that scale, it will come in some other way. And Jeffrey, you're exploring this in your books, I know. So, and you know, over even vaster scales, cosmically. I think she's really trying to address an actual problem that she's seeing, is that there is a disintegration of a public sense of faith in future, in purpose, in something that transcends the fractious reality of contemporary life.
And certainly nation states are in decline. So, I mean, that's part of the reason why they're not investing that way, is because in a sense they're losing popular support. It sounds an odd thing to say for a government, but they are. I mean, you know, people are investing their time and effort in other ways than they used to spend in supporting democratic governments. So, you know, and that's part of the problem. So I agree, something has to take the place of the sort of collective engagements that the nation state at one point might have served, but in a particular kind of way.
Yeah, I think you're right. In France, they did a study with young people, saying that, you know, if tomorrow there is war with Algeria, which was, you know, we had a war like 20 years ago, and which side will you take? And French young people said, oh, I will become Algerian right away because I don't want a war. So, well, it could be understandable because, you know, like, French people have so much war that they prefer to abandon everything and become the other nation. But in Algeria, they are the kind of a strong state nation, and they have all their identity built around their nation. So they asked the same question in the Algeria part, and they had the same answer from the young people, and they get really amazed because they really propagate the idea of, you know, being Algerian and this idea of nation and being together, and it was not working. And the young say the same than the French people, that if France can and trying to do the war, they will become French because they really don't mind about anything, but they just want peace. And so I guess this political point of view of building gathering around the idea of sharing nation or religion even are really not working somehow. So we need to find something else to engage people in the, and I guess that I'm not saying that the nation is a good thing to engage because it leads to so much war that is really, from my point of view, I don't want to judge that, but it's not a good way to gather people. But trying to find something else is not that easy because religion can behave as a nation. And for some religious people, they are the nation. Like for example, the Christians, they call themselves nation. The Muslims, they call themselves nation. And that means if you are not in part of the nation, you cannot, you are like either way with or without this group. And I mean, against even this group. And that leads to all kind of issue, all kind of conflict issues. And I guess that people, our young people want maybe something else. And it's difficult to find something else that really share a universal point of view and gathering around something that's it's mutually engaging. So it's, but I guess what she did here, sharing an emotion like this, is really something that is universal. I'm not saying that is what should trigger people, but when we look at the old religion, before the Greek happened, like the god Tammuz, or they use this technique. I mean, sorry to say this way, but they use, children death, to gather people around some strong feeling and to enhance the civic feeling of people to be together. And so it's something that's really worked. And I'm not saying it's the way to go, but I'm saying that is interesting the way she brings this story here.
I would maybe question that we need something to replace the nation state. I wonder if there's something intrinsically, there's an intrinsic problem with things that are that large. Maybe what matters, and maybe what the French and Algerian young people were feeling, maybe what matters is local, is the smaller communities. I'm asking. Maybe you guys have some thoughts on that. But I think that we see that in this book too, that despite Lauren's grand scale, most of what she actually does is at a very small scale, a very human, small community kind of scale. And I wonder if that is... And her scale still, her vision still is enormous, but part of me thinks that maybe big visions are part of the problem.
Well, I don't know. I was just trying to bring a short answer. I think that you're right. Like a big vision, it's maybe not the answer. Because if what the young French and Algerian people didn't like is to embrace something that they were never part of. Like when you are in a big group, you have to withdraw some of your singularity, some of your own belief to be agreeing with, to follow the flow and to forget about yourself somehow. And when you have a strong nation identity, it means that you should fit the bigger part of the group, but it always leads to not including everything in there. And it also shows this in the book somehow, that it is like, when you are not with, you are against somehow, and it's the whole concept. And we are human beings, we're not like this. One day we can say, oh, I love blue, and the second day we say, oh, yeah, I prefer red, I'm sure of that. And we change all the time. We are like changing people, we change our identity. We felt like our identity has to be like in one block, but in fact, every single second we may change point of views. And this idea of nation, that state nation, that you should be like this, is like you have a country that identifies themselves as principles that cannot be moved. And so it's difficult for people to get linked to something that is not strongly related to their own way of being somehow. That it can change and it can be different, and it's somehow a tyranny to impose to people to be always the same. So it's, I guess it's also, the book is also about that, that you have to love your children, but when the children are not there anymore, like, you have the right to change also. You have the, you know, the right also to put aside your guiltiness. And I mean, it's really raising a lot of questions. I guess that your question is really deep in that way, because it's really enhancing one part of the book. Like, she doesn't think clearly that it's that, but she, the way you put it in question is really interesting, because it's, even by trying to answering it and building category, it's also misleading somehow. So yeah, it's really rich.
Because she's talking about these different groups, that they're trying to launch a war, you know, that there's a war coming, and the different, you know, so you're right, she is addressing these questions in the very broader scale, even as she's focused on the micro community, the particular micro community that she's looking at. She's looking at the micro community in the larger framework of these larger forces going on in this disintegrating future, where these other forces are also in play. And it's interesting, because the discussion, because I mean, in a sense, I mean certainly before countries and nations emerged, you could have wars between one group and another group, but since the emergence of the nation state is the only, perhaps religions, but the maybe nation states and religious communities are the only ones who wage war. I mean, the nation state is the first entity that engages in war, and it was interesting that the example that you gave, Jocelyn, about the French and the Algerians is a question of war. So it may be more about not wanting to engage in war than identity in nation state per se. I mean, there's something else going. There's this sort of double thing going on there, which is interesting. But so there's a sense where, but Butler is talking about this idea that people need a war in order to, you know, they look for a war in order to engage in something else. So like young men, she talks about wanting to go to war in order to become more masculine or whatever. And so you have these sort of things that are being discussed in this context as well. So I'm not very good with complete thoughts today, but.
This is what the president, the new president, what's his name again? Donner? No, not Donner. That's what he's targeting. Like, you know, he's stoking those patriotic, nationalistic, jingoistic sentiments. And he's, in a way, this president, trying to give purpose to this nation that has become disintegrated. It's fallen into chaos. And so, you know, as happens when civil order breaks down, a strong man kind of leader raises up to give everybody a purpose. And maybe that purpose is that, you know, we have to get rid of this group of people, get rid of the heathens, get rid of the non-believers, get rid of the immigrants, the aliens, etc. It's a very the president as well as Al-Amina are both responding to the same need, but they're doing it at different scales and in different ways. I think the nation state, though, I mean, although it's an agent of war, from another point of view, it also is a way of preventing war amongst tribal identities. And, you know, it becomes a larger identity and it can mobilize more resources so it can be more destructive. But it has as much to do with order and stability as it does, I think, with aggression aggression and exclusion. So I don't think we would want to see our nation states break down. I mean, I think it wouldn't lead to a utopia. It would lead to much more likely lead to dystopia than utopia. So, you know, I've had the thought and I've engaged the argument that that we should transcend our nation states and find some other, you know, anarchistic or other means of organizing. But realistically, if that were to happen tomorrow, nation states, you know, just stopped existing, it would be chaos, I think. And we'd figure something else out, but I don't think what we figure out would necessarily be better than what we have now. So, I mean, that sort of that historical evolution, like, progress, I think, is very—it's very difficult, and that's part of what Butler, I think, is also here dealing with, is that change is not easy. It's not a linear process. Like, we can't just posit a better future and just get there by straightforward effort. It's a lot more fraught than that.
Yeah, I think this is making me think of a lot of things, especially because of, I guess we're all talking from different contexts, and the one I'm speaking from is sort of in a Europe that's really entrenching its borders and boundaries in quite a violent and just causing a lot of death, Fortress Europe. But then again, also coming from, half Greek and, you know, my great-grandparents come from what is now Turkey, and these nation states only existed because you had this sort of multi-ethnic, multi-religious area, region where people that was just destroyed through the creations of these nation states. So I think the creations of nation states are so violent, and now all of these different European countries trying to entrench their own, what they see to be, seemingly static identities is also a very violent process. So I think it's interesting to see how reading this book speaks to the different places where we are, and also the fact of just total continuous war in different ways. Like, the British Army's been deployed different countries at war every year since the only one that's not was, I think, in 1968 or something. Apart from that, it's just continuously at war somewhere. And I think that reflecting on, depending on where you are, and a lot of, I think a lot of the time it's easy to forget that. But I think also in the US context, it's so interesting how much the war on whatever is used as a slogan. I mean, you can tell me I'm being silly, but you know, the war on drugs or the war on terror or the war on gangs. I don't know. It's just constantly this rhetoric that's used. And just on a completely different side note, but I noticed that Time magazine, I don't know if you saw it, but Time magazine had this article just a few weeks ago. I can just put it in the chat. It's quite silly, but it was like, I was just looking for things in the media that mentioned Butler, and it was a book, one of the books that predicted the future. So it's kind of interesting to see how the Parable series is being taken up in a wider sense.
We do like wars in the United States. So that's not silly. That's a common theme. Even something good, we have to make war to achieve it. War on cancer, whatever it is.
Yeah, the war on cancer is, or that kind of the war on, you know, sickness or illness is a ongoing discussion in the professional environment that I work in, which is in a rehab clinic, where this kind of analogy used to describe, which is still used, you know, whenever they want to raise money, it becomes, you know, this kind of language is used, and you can't run a medical clinic based on a war mentality, and so it's counterproductive to do this, even though it seems to work in terms of raising money, but in terms of actually operating on that basis, can't be done. It's a complete nonsense.
I guess that war is an interesting concept because it's a way of it's like a cathartic action to feel all together a union towards a goal. And it's interesting because the Greek did that with theater, and you know, the show, the drama of one person you know, expressing, you know, dramatic action in order to get approval with the others that the action was right. And I guess that war is interesting in that way because it's really reaching our deepest emotion, at the more primal emotion somehow, but really working with gathering people around. The only thing is when you lose the war, and it's not the same than having this effect. I mean, the effect is very interesting somehow for this, and it can be even, it's more virtual than real. But when you apply this concept of war for real, and then everyone lose, even the winner, so to speak, because there is only one person that is alone, and the other people are not there anymore to justify the action. So it's a tricky situation. And I guess it's the reason why also video games work so well, because in video games, you can trigger all this gathering with all the people. I'm thinking about World of Warcraft and things that are really addictive. And it's all based on this, that you have to join the community, you have to get help from others. And so you can play on your own, but if you play with others, it's really going to give you an edge, and you will succeed. And what is really addictive is that it's fighting for the right cause somehow and be all together engaged in some kind of conflict. But what is engaging is not resolution of conflict, it's more the gathering and everyone looking at the same, in the same way, in the same direction. And that really triggers amazing feeling with that. And I guess the nation state is all set up on this on this idea that we all together to fight for the same cause, and we all together because we are better than the other that is not inside the nation. whoever what the Octavia Butler present is that, well, if the children dies, you will feel this feeling is way out the feeling of gathering and religion and war and state nation, and it's something universal. And she brings like a level zero of the feeling that in her demonstration, I guess that she's really trying to find a universal way of showing that all our understanding of gathering and understanding of being together can be not as right as we feel it could be. I'm not sure I was clear on this. Sorry.
I'd like to read from chapter 2, just the Urseed quote, which is about chaos. And that is God's most dangerous face, amorphous, roiling, hungry. Then she says, shape chaos, shape God, act. So everybody has their own way of shaping chaos. And we're talking about the war metaphor later on in that chapter. I guess it's the part where it's mentioned the Make America Great statement, but I'll read that little bit too, and it kind of speaks to what we're talking about here. So she's mentioning how it was a nice day until she was realized about, reminded of Jared again. And she says, the thing is, you can't separate Jared from the religious nonsense. You take Jared and you get beatings, burnings, tarrings, and featherings. They're a package. And there may be even nastier things in that package. Jarrett's supporters are more than a little seduced by Jarrett's talk of making America great again. He seems to be unhappy with certain other countries. We could wind up in a war, nothing like a war to rally people around a flag, a country, a great leader. And then she goes on talking about how some of her people are leaving because they want to be safe. So they find security in Jarrett's message. So they go on to say that we have four children, we want our children to survive. So in a way, there might be talk in the Make America Great Again, we're going to save your children too here, so come to us. So Lauren doesn't really have that promise, but she's also, I don't know what I want to say there, but not, I don't know how to phrase how she is or how her word.
Well, she sees how short-sighted that is. I mean, she sees that that is not ultimately going to work. And I think the Urseed idea is an attempt to provide a solution to that problem. That people need to have something that unifies them. They need to have a collective vision. But it has to be something that is creative rather than destructive. And so I think that the Urseed idea is creative. It's about life. It's about propagating life. And it's about certain kinds of virtues or ethics that one practices, not because they're intrinsically like platonically right, but because of the way that change works, because of the nature of reality in this system of belief. Like if one acts in a certain way, it will produce conditions that support life. And if one fails to act in those ways, then it will result in chaos, destruction, death. So I think that that's, I think it's a really, I'm kind of mulling on this because I think it's a really, serious problem actually. Like if we look at the spiritual level of what's going on culturally, socially, in the world, there's such a crisis of meaning. I know that, there are many different ways of fulfilling that for individuals, but I don't know how that really is playing out on a larger scale. I mean, on a larger scale, I see meaning-making structures and systems more breaking down than building up. And maybe that's good too. Maybe it has to come from the ground. Maybe it has to be grassroots or whatever. Maybe like many, many different approaches or ideologies or belief systems or groups or communities is what's required. But the tribalism has its problems too. Like, it's where I think our emotional life is most fulfilled, in smaller groups. Those groups have to be able to get along with each other. And so there has to be a common context for those. And if it's not the nation state, then what is it? A planetary governance or an anarchic kind of decentralized cyber utopian, sort of planetary civilization? I hope that this is relevant to Miranda, to your research, because I think that's really kind of the question. It's like, how do we envision a future that doesn't, where we can't rely on the big, structures that we've grown up with? I think this is one way of this is like an imaginative thought experiment in that, but I think it's really trying to get at a real problem.
Don't want to cut anybody off, but just wanted to state that The Book of Martha, which is a short story I've mentioned somewhere else, by Octavia Butler, really ties in the religious as well as the visionary utopian side of things. So I'm hoping, if we're able to, the recording's available on YouTube, but if we're able to, maybe in the last discussion or in an alternate discussion, we can kind of relate that to the parable series. But it really answers a lot of, not necessarily answers, but gives more meat, flesh to this discussion. So just wanted to add that real quick.
That's a great idea, Doug. Did you post the link on one of the threads for that?
I'll do that sometime today or tomorrow.
Because that would be great if we could, because we'll have the next one will be the second half of the book, but we have planned a wrap-up session after that, and we could focus maybe the wrap-up partly on the YouTube recording of that. Would be an interesting conclusion to the discussion group. The other thing I wanted to say is that I'm mindful. I mean, one of the distractions that I've had in the last couple of weeks while I've been trying to read and progress in this book is, so I know in the US you have your own election issues going on, but in Quebec we have a provincial election going on right now. And the issue of immigration has come front and center for the campaigns, raised by a somewhat right of center group initially. But what's interesting about it is the group that I sometimes support and used to support has come out also with a critical perspective to opening the gates for immigration. And so two of the political parties in the discussion have come out critical of immigration in Quebec, and the other two parties are in opposite. And they're not the typical, they're not the two right-wing groups and the two left-wing groups. They're one right-wing group and one somewhat left-wing group. And then the other two are sort of in between those groups. So it's an odd political context. And the other interesting part is that the polls that have been done of people suggest that there is much more popular support for immigration than any of the political parties seem to realize or recognize. And so, but there are some issues that come up in the polls. So there are questions about how people are being integrated into the culture. But there, in general, people are favorable towards immigration. So this is also mixing up the. So, but it's interesting reading Butler's book and thinking about the context of what's going on right now in Quebec.
Thank you.
This is probably not pertinent to everyone else here, Jeffrey, but what's the left-wing party that's come out against immigration as a fellow Quebecois?
The Parti Québécois has said that the that immigration should be restricted in Quebec.
Okay. All right, thanks.
They've lost my confidence, I'm afraid.
So. Yeah. Thank you.
To return back to the question of, that you were asking Marco about whether this is interesting. It's all really interesting in terms of how the project that I'm doing about collective reading and future making practices through text. So again, thanks for having me as part of your discussions. And I'll just briefly say that if a few of you that haven't signed the consent form, if you're interested in that, I can post the link again. I think Donna, Justine and Mary, you haven't. And so if it's that you don't want to participate in the project, that's also fine. But
That just fell off my list. But I would be happy to sign it. Maybe you should repost it. Yeah. Thanks.
Well, thank you. I didn't realize that you were on the side of a ship or something. So I'm sorry about that.
No, it was away.
Mostly been talking North American context, a little bit of Europe, but Donna's in the Middle East, and I'm curious if she has any reflections on nation state, transcendent purpose, religion, and politics, as opposed to the book. Not a loaded question.
In the Middle East, we are still living in the nation states. I think after post-colonialism, all the countries are living in the nation states. The idea of religion, actually, the book itself, the basic theme is religion and belief. Lauren created this new system of belief, but the setting, the chaos around, does it really need a new system of belief? She's just living in this, trying to say God is change and this and that. But I think what they really need is to step out, take action, and not just keep on. You know, like her daughter said in one of the chapters that she felt that Lauren is like her mother. You know, her mother, she resorted to drugs, and Lauren, in a way, she resorted in creating this religion and, you know, and trying to, I don't want to say hide behind this system of belief, but in a way, when I kept reading the novel itself, I felt furious. At certain points, I hated Lauren, and I'm like, do we really need a new system of belief, a religion? We in this region, in the Middle East, we are now revisiting the religion, and we are revisiting, and we are reading religion from a historical point of view. And do we need a system of belief? Do we need a God to move us and to do this or that? We've been using this for going into wars, for convincing people, for converting people, for doing this and that. And this is where we are today, in this region. Is this really what we need, a new system of belief? For me personally, I don't think so. Marco, you said something about meaning. Would religion create a meaning for me? I don't think so. I don't think that I would find answers in religion, in a system, in a belief. And even, usually religions, they would have this definite reality and definite truth, and this is it, and nothing, this is what you'll have, and there's nothing outside this. And Lauren was against that, but really, basically, when her brother, she asked him to argue, she did the same. The whole argument between him and between the people of Earthseed, they refused him. They didn't accept to listen. And even she, in a way, I felt she showed him as this weak, not ready, but still he has his own belief and you did not accept that. And you accepted and you said that the only reality is within Earthseed. But what if there is another reality? And what if there are other people who are believing in other things? And why do, I mean, the people, I felt the people who in a way were in that community out of convenience, because outside they might get killed, food is not there. I don't know. I mean, this is how I felt. Sometimes even you would go to a community, to a religion, you would immigrate to another country out of because you want to be safe, you want to do this and that. But I mean, I don't know. I felt, in a way, she did not convince me, Lauren, in thinking that the answer is Earthseed and this and that. And then saying the future, when she talked about the future, that yes, people will go out to other planets. But really, look at Earth. Did we really were responsible enough to find or to live or to even save Earth in from an environmental perspective, from respecting ourselves? I mean, they became slaves. People became slaves and chaos and everything. And then you're thinking, well, yeah, we go to other planets. I mean, we will ruin other planets if we just go to other planets. This is how I feel.
I think you've noticed a lot of things, Donna, that I think I agree with. As much sympathy and as much good that I think Lauren did, it's very interesting that, for example, she requests that people who come to her community not proselytize for their own religion. So she has actually made a rule that restricts people's ability to talk about to speak freely about their own beliefs, which is interesting, which is an interesting nuance, you know. As much as you might agree with what she is generally doing, there is a certain expediency to some of the choices that she makes.
I also thought it was interesting, Donna, because Marco's question earlier is, do you think the Earthseed community is a viable community? But in a way, your question is it convincing for me? Which is a different question, right? So I agree that it's, I still haven't quite understood why I find this idea of shaping God as interesting. That's the part of the Earthseed thing that I find is an idea that somehow appeals in some sense, but not on its own. It would have to be in some sort of a broader context in which it wasn't just about shaping God, but something, you know, something broader. But, and I still haven't quite teased that out, but generally speaking, the Earthseed community doesn't sound very attractive to me. So I agree with you.
Well, there are some modern religious movements that, and even variants on traditional religious movements that embrace a active role for human agency in shaping God, for, you know, in other terms. What I'm thinking of is the conscious evolution idea, whereby humans become co-creators with the universe or with spirit in shaping the future, and that this becomes the sort of union of the scientific evolutionary perspective that forms can evolve and adapt with a religious or a spiritual perspective that, you know, our interior lives or our relationship with the divine can evolve and adapt, and we can play a role in that. So I think that she's coming at this from a particular point of view, but it actually has real life examples. And you know, I've been associated with some of them in some ways. Like they all call themselves evolutionary spirituality or conscious evolution or, you know, those kinds of ideas. And it's not like a religion in the same way, but there's definitely a spiritual practice, spiritual kind of, you know, worldview about how the cosmos evolves over time and the role that humans can play in shaping that. And then if you combine that with technology and AI and the idea that, you know, we could nano engineer the future and bioengineer, you know, new bodies for ourselves and things like that, it can flesh itself out in some pretty detailed ways. So yeah.
Yeah, great. One of the books that we're looking at for a follow-up reading group, it's a book raised by another person who's participating in the different forums on the Infinite Conversation site, is the book called Last and First Men by Olaf Stapledon. And Stapledon has a very long view of the universe, which looks at these very sort of millions of years into the future, the future of humankind that far ahead in the future. And Last and First Men is the first part of a two book series thing that deals with this kind of question. The other one being Star Maker. And so so we're looking possibly at doing a reading group on that book or those books. So.
You know, before we, I know we're getting, Jeffrey, to the top of the hour, I'd like to respond to Miranda's research question, because, this is just a personal statement. I'm not an adherent of a particular faith. I don't practice a particular faith. I grew up Catholic. But if I had one, if I had to name one, it would probably be literature. And so if I'm looking for meaning, you know, views on what reality is, whatever, transcendent, I tend to look to literature for that. Like, this is like, for me, I'm not saying that this is what it objectively is for anybody else, but for me, it's sort of like a little, you know, church gathering. It's like a little religious gathering. And I think that's, to me, that's maybe an important, like, just to go back then to Mary's point about how Lauren begins to institute some kind of thought control systems, you know, some prohibitions on what people can, not on what they can question, but what they, you know, what can compete with her narrative, with her story. I think that's where I would part ways, is that for me, the utopia would be where there could be a proliferation of stories, a proliferation of worldviews and faiths. And I think that's what religion is. Like, each novel, each book, each poem is its kind of own faith in some kind of instance of meaning, you know, and an author will try to create their own religion, basically. So I guess we lost Mary, but I think that maybe that relates to your research question. I definitely read to figure out the future, to find portents of signs, prophecies, visions. I find that in literature.
Cool. That's really interesting. And I know that's the end of the 2 hours, but I look forward to carrying on discussions with you all in the next time we meet.
So, I'd like to finish it up since we're all busy people and I've got things to do this afternoon as well. As always, I am thrilled by the depth of the reading takes on a whole different understanding following the discussions each time. You know, I have my own, I sometimes feel it's very superficial understanding. After I listen to all the other stuff that comes up, I go, you know, how come I didn't see that? Or how, you know,
So, but it's always such an enriching experience to do these sessions to transform my reading of the book in new ways. So thanks for everyone for your contributions, and we'll see you all in 2 weeks for the next installment.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Please, bye.